by His divine grace, Srila Prabhupada. The lifetime of such an envious householder is passed at night, either in sleeping or in sex indulgence, and in the daytime, either in making money or maintaining family members. So please repeat. The lifetime of such an envious householder,
the lifetime of such an envious householder,
is passed at night,
is passed at night,
either in sleeping, or in sex indulgence,
or in sex indulgence.
And in the daytime,
and in the daytime,
either in making money,
either in making money,
or maintaining family members,
or maintaining family members.
Purport. The present human civilization is primarily based on the principles of sleeping and sex indulgence at night, and earning money in the day and spending the same for family maintenance. Such a form of human civilization is condemned by the Bhagavad school. Because human life is a combination of matter and spirit soul, the whole process of Vedic knowledge is directed at liberating the spirit soul from the contamination of matter. The knowledge concerning this is called Atma-tattva. Those men who are too materialistic are unaware of this knowledge and are more inclined to economic development for material enjoyment. Such materialistic men are called karmis, or fruitive laborers, and they are allowed regulated economic development or association of women for sex indulgence. Those who are above the karmis, that is, the gyanis, yogis, and devotees, are strictly prohibited from sex indulgence. The karmis are more or less devoid of atma-tattva, and as such, their life is spent without spiritual profit. The human life is not meant for hard labor for economic development, nor is it meant for sex indulgence, like that of the dogs and hogs. It is especially meant for making a solution to the problems of material life and the miseries thereof. So the karmis waste their valuable human life by sleeping and sex indulgence at night, and by laboring hard in the daytime to accumulate wealth, and after so doing, they try to improve the standard of materialistic life. The materialistic way of life is described herein in a nutshell, and how foolish men waste the boon of human life is described as follows. Om Agnatimran Hudasyam Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshurasam Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Prachandine Nivasesha Sunyavadi Pashyata Deshatari. So thank you everyone for coming this morning. In the second canto, Srila Prabhupada describes how a devotee should not read beyond the second canto if they're not free from material desire. So I'll end the class here. Thank you. No, what that actually means is that even though we may be conditioned or have material desires, we should understand the standards of devotional life and the ultimate goal, which is to free ourselves completely from the influences of petty selfishness or material desire, and to ultimately come to the point of pure, unadulterated, loving service to Sri Sri Radha and Krishna. This purport is a striking example into the actual standards of devotional practice. For most of us, our religious backgrounds and upbringing And we can safely say that throughout the world, the goal of religion and the practical application of religion is praying and worshiping God for material achievement, material successes, and ultimately for liberation. However, Srimad Bhagavatam begins by discounting this. Just like many of you are familiar with this term, mukti, or liberation. You see? And in the West, we have the term salvation. You see? You must accept religious practice, religious teachings to gain salvation. Of course, and as I've mentioned, we can easily change that term from salvation or liberation to saving your neckism, or saving our neckism. You see? That we're worshiping God to free ourselves from material problems, whether it's immediately by asking for some benefit, material benefit, or if it's ultimately we're just become tired with material pursuit. And how many of us are tired? Raise your hand if you're tired. This struggle, especially in modern society, which has escalated the fever of material achievement to the point to an exhaustive degree, is actually very tiring. I was talking with a man recently. He told me when this was only, I think he was mentioned, he mentioned the year now, I can't remember clearly, but I think it was about 25 years ago, he bought his HDB flat for 25,000 Singapore dollars. Now in the course of 25 years, the price has gone up to almost 200,000 Singapore dollars. The pace for material achievement is just escalating. Now I heard a private flat just sold for $15 million. Here on Bayshore condominiums. You see? So to achieve that type of material success, practically speaking, for most of us, is a great over-endeavor. And yet we are being stimulated, we are being fed, we are being allured into this exhaustive, unnecessary lifestyle by the media and propaganda. It's like you can watch any television program, and what will you see? You will simply see people being portrayed in a very luxuriant and almost, you know, completely irresponsible lifestyles, which is totally untrue. Even the elite, the very wealthy, very elite, rich of the modern world are plagued with personal difficulties and problems. I have a godbrother who runs a cleaning service in the United States, where I live in Dallas. And he goes to these fabulously wealthy homes, like the big estates, multi-million dollar estates. And he tells me it's so shocking because nobody is in the home except for a few dogs. Literally, he's being paid just to take care of cleaning up for the dogs. And why? Either the people are so engrossed in trying to maintain that standard of life that they are not, you can't even find them in the home. They're either in their office or in their own business from the early morning until late at night. Or they've completely, neglected their family and their friends and their everything to just concentrate and to focus on that level of achievement, so that they're practically left friendless and familyless. And he told me it's surprising how many of the wealthy homes that he goes to, there's just one person living there. See? the Western lifestyle now, if you look at statistics, America has a divorce rate of 7 out of 10. 7 out of 10 marriages end in divorce. This very glamorous, passionate expression of feminine beauty, which has become the most prominent aspect of Western life and now even in India. When you look at it practically, it is the downfall of the entire world. Previously, Indian culture respected and cherished womanhood for the qualities of chastity, for the qualities of devotion. Women were respected on the level of like goddesses because they maintained these qualities which are mentioned in Bhagavad Gita as divine qualities. Srila Prabhupada's mother is such a vivid example that she was so chaste that she wouldn't even go to her neighbor's home if she had not received an invitation, and she would be carried there in a palanquin so she wouldn't be seen in the street when she was going to her neighbor's home. This is in the late 1800s. Not even a little more than 100 years ago. You see? And nowadays, what we're practically seeing is that women are being so grossly exploited that practically they're like strippers of the most vulgar type, and yet they're being promoted to the level of like goddesses. Okay, now let's look practically at that. In the United States right now, as we sit here, one out of every two girls, 50% of all the girls that you see in the United States between the age of 14 and 24 will end up pregnant outside of marriage. One out of every two girls will have a child without being married. Okay? One out of every two of those girls, that means one out of every four girls that you see will have an abortion. So either their whole developed childhood and their opportunities for higher education will all be consumed by taking the responsibility of motherhood in such a difficult situation as trying to live in a society like this, where everything is so expensive, where practically, you know, just going to work and coming home takes up hours of your day. You see, a girl like that will be forced either to being giving up all of her higher educational privileges, all of her higher achievements. She'll be forced to be begging from the government for support. She'll be seen as a problem in her family. Or she'll just go and kill the child. This is what we're talking about here, practically. One out of every four girls in the United States right now between the age of 14 and 24 will kill her own child. This is the result of all this disco dancing and everything. They portray it on television like it's something and actually these things are attractive. Why? Why are they attractive? Because they are a perverted reflection of the eternal and pure love of Radhan Krishna. However, that love is not stained with the gross materialistic exploitation that's going on in the name of love and in the name of material progress. Indian society is undergoing tremendous change in this generation. And the Western corporate psychologists who are simply exploiting everyone they can for as much money as they can, they have conveniently couched this change, which is actually the degradation of the entire world, with the term progress. If your daughter can go into the street just like a dog looking for some sexual mate, now she is considered liberated and she is making progress. This is Western society. This is what we're talking about here. So this mentality is completely kicked out by Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, I wanted to focus on a few very practical things for all of us today as devotees. I've been doing a book table here at the Viram Kaliman Mandir, very kindly by the arrangement of Devaki Nandana and the administrators here. And I've become a tour guide for most of the Western foreign tourists who stand at the steps wondering if they can even come into the temple. And what's surprising is so many of them are interested, so deeply interested, that they'll buy books. And even I've had a number of conversations with, just yesterday I have a conversation with a couple from England who are both retired. The man is a civil engineer from England, and his wife was an educator. I can't remember exactly what position was. However, they both told me, look, we're no longer, our children are grown up, we've just retired from our occupations, and we'd really like to dedicate ourselves to some worthy cause, but we don't know what to do. And we've seen so many, charitable causes or good causes that are actually, bad. So we're confused. So what I did is I gave them our card for Food for Life Global. Food for Life Global right now, which was started by Srila Prabhupada, our founder, in 1974, is the largest international relief agency just beneath the United Nations. We are distributing over 700,000 meals per day in 72 countries. And what's so unique about Food for Life is that it's mostly young men and women, or retired men and women, small businessmen and women, or educators of different types, that are simply taking their own money and time and performing relief work as devotional service to Srila Prabhupada. And so what's so unique is that Food for Life Global is 95% volunteer, which is very, very nice, because there's not the tremendous amount of overhead that normally is plaguing and even breaking down some of the largest charitable institutions in the world. Just like 2 weeks ago, the National Kidney Foundation here was disclosed by accounting report that only 3 cents of every $100 that's donated to the National Kidney Foundation is actually used for relief work. 3 cents out of $100. Where does the rest of that money go? To the beautiful facility that they have, to the very high salaries that the staff is keeping. But Food for Life is not like that. Most of the members in the Food for Life staff support themselves. So because of that, Food for Life, even though if you look at it side by side, if you took our members and put us next to the National Kidney Foundation, we look almost like nothing, right? However, the relief work that can be achieved by this small group can actually surpass what such a large foundation is doing, practically speaking. 700,000 meals per day is no joke. The United Nations is combining United Way, Red Cross, Blue Cross, all of these institutions together And we almost distribute as many meals as they do. You see? Once in Dallas, we had this interfaith dialogue with some Jesuit priests from the Vatican in Rome. And they were telling us that, side by side with a Christian church in America, a Hare Krishna temple, a temple of the International Society of Krishna Consciousness, seems like nothing. You know, like in Dallas, our temple's been there for 33 years. We have 5,000 members in our congregation. For Janmashtami, you'll see about 5,000 people. On a regular Sunday feast program, like your Saturday evening program, we have it on Sunday evening, and we get about 400 congregational members to come, and we get about 400 people to come to our restaurant. Annual visitors, who mostly are coming to our restaurant, we get about 40,000 people a year. Okay, now, but the initiated devotees, the group of initiated devotees that are active, I would say are about maybe 100 to 150 people. But what this Jesuit priest pointed out to us, he said, if you came to our church on Sunday, you'd see a huge congregation, like sometimes you may have seen on these television programs, these Christian television programs, especially from America. Well, it seems like it's like an auditorium. Their churches are like auditoriums. But what he told us was that but when you look at it practically, there's only a couple of people who are actually doing the missionary work. You see? Whereas in a group like this, all of you are doing missionary work. So side by side, you can actually accomplish much, much more. Srila Prabhupada is recognized by some of the greatest international scholars of religion, such as A.L. Basham. And Srila Prabhupada is accredited with having achieved so much success that A.L. Basham even says that Prabhupada has surpassed the achievements of Jesus Christ. Srila Prabhupada ki. Prabhupada literally, single-handedly took the teachings of Krishna consciousness and spread it over the entire world. Prabhupada now is responsible for over 800 million editions of his books in 72 languages. Prabhupada is responsible for thousands and even millions of people, even though they may not be initiated. Like in America, they took a Gallup poll recently and they asked people, what is your religious, what religion are you? And we had almost 1 million people report that they were followers of Krishna consciousness. In a university like Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, our Guru Maharaj, Tamal Krishna Goswami, who was the Victorian student of the university, he took more awards at the university than any person in the history of the school. And I tell you, when he was there studying, we used to get phone calls. They called Tamal Krishna Maharaj at the university, they called him Mr. Goswami, and we would get calls from like the biggest corporations in Dallas. Is Mr. Goswami there? We say, oh, no, we're his secretary. I'm sorry, he's very busy right now. They say, no, I'm from such and such corporation. We'd like to offer him a job. We got at least 20 or 30 calls like that, companies because of it. Because they, these big companies, they look at the achievements, the students who are gaining the awards in the university, and they try to offer jobs and get them on their teams, like that. So, he was a Victorian student at the university. And what he found was at SMU, he became very close with especially the assistant dean there, whose name was Dr. Clear. He was a senior professor at the university for over 35 years. And just to give you a little idea of what we're talking about as a university, SMU, Southern Methodist University, not the Singapore Management University. But the Southern Methodist University of Dallas, Texas, which is a Christian-based, private university, and it is considered the best university in Dallas, Texas. Okay, they, during the time when Tamal Krishna Maharaj was there, they did a lunch-in fundraiser at the university, a lunch-in fundraiser, okay? So for two days, for about an hour and a half each day, they conducted a fundraiser for the university. How much money do you think they raised? Okay, anyone who'd like to answer that question? Two lunch hours, like three hours, hour and a half one day, hour and a half the next day, for 2 days. How much money do you think they raised at Southern Methodist University at this fundraiser? Take a guess. Anybody, please.
10 million.
How much?
10 million.
$10 million. This is, I guess. Anybody else?
500 million.
Yeah, that's right. They raised $500 million in two lunch hours. And they were making jokes with Tamal Krishna Maharaj because they didn't even have anything vegetarian in the lunch. And they were saying, wow, somebody like you can't even come to you know, give a donation. There's nothing to eat. Raised over a half a billion dollars, you know. There were people walking in there, just like the university, the family that donates for the religious studies department of Southern Methodist University. They're known as the Deadman family. They're business people in Dallas. You can see them walking down the sidewalk, you know, in downtown Dallas occasionally. And they came in, they wrote out a check for $40 million. We have another family, the Trammell Crow family in Dallas. Very unique family. If you go to Dallas, Texas, and you go into, they're the main commercial property owners of the city, in the city of Dallas. And if you go to any one of their buildings, you will see deities from India and China. Even I remember seeing one deity that's over 5,000 years old. They have deities of Krishna. Their family collects deities from India and China. Deities of Lord Brahma, deities of Lord Shiva. Practically every office building in Dallas, this family. And they came in, they wrote out a check, also a $40 million check. But what I'm trying to say is, in a university whose families, you know, can give that type of money, the students there, Tamal Krishna Maharaj had become friends with these professors. He was inviting them on numerous occasions to our temple for every practical excuse he could. Like we had a Christmas party. You know, in the temple we put up a Christmas tree, we wrapped Christmas gifts, we made all this whole Christmas party. We invited the whole staff there for Christmas. We invited them for every practical excuse we could. But what we found out, what Tamal Krishna Maharaj found out, was in a university like that, which you would think would be a disinterested Christian academic environment, practically every professor and most of the students had such a strong interest in Krishna consciousness that the six main professors that he was working with, all of them had been to our temples, all of them had gone to India, one of them's mother lives in an ashram in India. One of them, what was told to Tamal Krishna Maharaj is that these men and women are tired of their lives because it is so exhaustive and because they've rehashed their ways of thinking so many times they practically had become bored with their Western philosophy and Western upbringing and Western religions. And Krishna consciousness was so refreshing because it was such a culture, such a wonderful culture. I mean, even just look at the food. Let's just look at the food. Once we had a big Janmashtami celebration in Dallas, so we invited television station to come. I think it was Fox 4. Anyway, so I was the head priest at the temple at that time, and so I was conducting the affairs on the altar. So the ladies, men and women, had cooked, I think we had about 350 preparations for Janmashtami that year, and we put them in these beautiful clay bowls, and we displayed them all on the altar in front of the deities for the midnight arti. So one of the television reporters with his camera, you know, he came up, he was filming everything, and there's this big kirtan going on, you know, devotees are all singing and dancing, and it's all decorated, and the deities are just beautiful. Just so beautiful. And so we made the offering on the altar, And the man came over to the altar with his camera, and he put the camera down. I'm standing just near him, and he said, "Wow, look at the food!" And the guy started coming right up on the altar with the camera, you know, filming it. Like, and I told him, "Hey, sir, you can't come up here like this. You know, you're supposed to be wearing a dhoti and everything." He put the camera down. He said, "Well, I've never seen anything like this, you know." And the guy literally just pushed me out of the way and started filming, you know, up onto the altar, you know. Yeah. I remember even when I joined, I was 17. You know, and I had become a vegetarian because of some friends of mine. They were older than I, and they were husband and wife, and they were both registered nurses, but they were vegetarians, and they had convinced me to become a vegetarian for health reasons. So I had already become a vegetarian. But when I came to the temple, the feast and the prasad was so good. Like, I didn't even think like I was missing something. You know what I mean? I didn't even think about it. Another example I can give you is just like sometimes we invite this Manipuri dance troupe to the United States. I know they've come here before. I saw it, this maybe is years ago. But you can see on their website, they have a very nice website. It's called RanganiKetan.com. And they are the number one performing arts troupe from India. They were primarily were organized by our late Acharya, his divine grace, Bhakti Sarup Damodar Goswami, and still his disciples are organizing their tours. And we brought them to Dallas on a number of occasions, and there were two girls whom my wife and I fell in love with. They had been trained since the age of 3 in classical Manipuri dance, but also in martial arts. And these girls, at that the time I'm recalling now, I think they were 18, one was 18 and one was 20 years old. So at that time, I was working with His Holiness Gunagrari Goswami, who is not only is a sannyasi and a wonderful devotee and disciple of Srila Prabhupada, but he's also a professional musician. And you can see him like on this on the video films from Poland, which is another very exciting program. Indra Dumna Maharaj organizes about 200 to 300 devotees each year, and they tour across Poland, and they have a setup. Of a tent. They have a tent which is the size of 3 football fields. And they have this program, they call it Krishna's Village of Peace. And the highlight of this tour each year, which is just amazing, it's amazing. If you haven't seen the DVD, the video film, you can order it from KL, from the BBT. They have the 1997 video footage of it. I just ordered it. But there's actually more up-to-date films. But they have one festival there which is called Woodstock. And it's organized by a non-profit corporation and one man in particular. And the devotees put up this village there called Krishna's Village of Peace. And they're having kirtans with over 400,000 kids at this festival. This festival draws almost 500,000 people. And they have a crew of devotees, 300 devotees that organize this festival. And it is just so amazing to see. And so anyway, the Manipuri dance troupe, when we brought them to Dallas, these two girls, age of 3, up to 18 or 20 years old, trained in martial arts. So, Gunagrai Maharaj was personal friends. And you could see Gunagrai Maharaj on this video footage playing music for this crowd, this 400,000 kids in Poland. He tours with the Nidumna Maharaj almost every year. So he was in Dallas, and he was friends with the owner of the Brook May Pro Music Shop. Now, this is a big music shop that sells musical equipment for like the top rock and roll bands and country western bands and top professional entertainers that that live in Dallas or that come to Dallas. It's a big music store. So he invited this owner to come to this Manipuri performance. Now, two things. One was when these girls began to demonstrate their martial arts. I don't know if you've seen this. But they have these small shields. They're about this big. And they use this sword. This sword is amazing, you know. Just looking at it gives you, you know, that makes your hair stand up. You could feel it, this thing just cutting your head off like a knife going through hot butter, you know. It's just like, wow, you know. And then here's this girl, you know, they look so petite and cute, you know, just laughing. You know.
Yet when they get on stage and they start to perform,
wow!
Like, they brought the audience out of their seats, standing up, and three times during their performance. You know, they're fighting so hard with these swords that when they hit the swords, sparks cascade off of the swords.
It is amazing. Totally amazing.
And when the drummers, like you've seen those Manipur drummers, right? They play a type of mridanga from Manipur thin. But this Krishna consciousness movement was introduced into Manipur during the time of Narottam Das Thakur. Actually, he, Srinivas Acharya, and Shamananda Pandit introduced and initiated the king of Manipur into Gaudiya Vaishnavism almost 500 years ago. So their culture is tied very closely with us. In fact, you can find Manipuri temples in Navadvip, where the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya. So then the Manipuri guys came out and they're doing this incredible drum performance with all these fancy things and, you know, singing, and they make their turban fall off in a really unique way while they're playing, and they dance and they practically do like cartwheels while they're playing. So afterwards, we asked this owner of this top professional music shop. He said, you know, I want to tell you guys, I have never seen anybody on this level of performing arts. This is the culture. And this culture is so outstanding because these achievements have been manifested, or they've been realized on account of the great devotion of the devotees, just like Srila Prabhupada. You see? And this is what actually attracts all of us, not just the conditioned souls, it attracts all of us to Krishna. And ultimately, the position, that attraction comes because of the love that devotees have for Krishna. Now, the love of God, it is based on what? Faith. Our love grows proportionate to Krishna to the level our faith increases. Now, I have a new book here that I want to show all of you, and I'll read a little bit from it, and then we'll stop because we're supposed to stop right now, right? 10:15. This book is written by His Holiness Shivaram Maharaj with a group of devotees from Hungary and some of us God brothers also, like His Holiness Keshavardi Maharaj and others. This book is called Shuddha Bhakta Chintamani. This book was written because His Holiness Shiva Maharaj has dedicated the remaining years of his life to create a 30-volume set of books which describes in detail and are written as a novel, which means you can even read them to your kids. They're fun to read. On the intimate pastimes of Radha and Krishna and the associates of Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. They are excellent books. The first book he produced was called the Venu Gita. The second book was called Na Pareham. The third book was called Krishna Sangati. Now, in the introduction of the Krishna Sangati, Shivaram Maharaj, he writes 120 page introduction. In that introduction, he explains the qualifications and that one should have in reading this literature. Just like I began this class, you know, with that point that Prabhupada makes, we should be free from material desires to read beyond, you know, to read from the second canto on. So the devotees began to question Shivaram Maharaj, what is the actual qualification and how to get that qualification? So Shivaram Maharaj went back to the drawing board and he spent 2 years and he's written this book, Shuddha Bhakta Chintamani, as the introduction to his 30-volume series. And this book explains what the qualifications are and how to achieve the qualifications for actually tasting pure love of God. It is so very, very, very good. It is so nice and it is so clear. Now, one of the things that I want you to touch on here, and I'm just, can I spend 5 more minutes with this? We got 5 more minutes? Okay. I wanted to touch on, because it's come up to my attention right here doing our book table here at this temple. So many people ask me, aren't you part of the group at the Krishna Mandir? Aren't you part? It's come to me many times, not just once, not just twice, not just 10 times, more than that. Aren't you the same group? And I'm showing them Bhagavad Gita and I'm showing them pictures of Srila Prabhupada. I saw his deity at the Krishna Mandir. Aren't you the same group? So what are you supposed to say? I meet people from a Bangalore here all the time. I'm from Bangalore ISKCON. You see? And they go on, and they're talking to you, So now Shiva Ram Maharaj has addressed this question. And I brought this question up not only for us, but also for our kids. Because in Dallas, I had a conversation recently, less than a month ago, with a girl who used to come to our temple when she was 9 years old. And at that time, we had our community service director also convert to becoming antagonistic to the devotees. And so without telling these kids what the differences were, this girl has lived, now she's 21 years old, she's lived for, 9 years old to 21. 12 years, completely outside of the association of devotees, without even knowing why. Because the parents would always say, we cannot tell you the reason. Simply, you cannot go there anymore. So now I had a conversation with a girl and I explained to her the reasons. She was so happy. And now her and her friends, they always come. They're helping me sometimes with my book distribution. So what Shiva Ram Maharaj writes here, and I just thought this was so crystal clear that I wanted to share this with you, because he gives this as a contemporary example for someone's level of faith. Now, when you read this book, Shiva Ram Maharaj is drawing primarily on the writings of Srila Jiva Goswami. Actually, he draws on many acharyas. He draws on Srila Prabhupada's work. He draws on, I'll just read you the list. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Srila Sanatana Goswami, Srila Rupa Goswami, and Srila Jiva Goswami. And he draws on their commentaries on the topic of developing faith and pure love of God. Now, in this particular section, he draws on two commentaries, one by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and the other is by Srila Jiva Goswami. They explain two types of mixed faith. In Sanskrit, we have a word, Shraddha, means faith. So there is pure Shraddha, but there's also mixed Shraddha, which is called Shraddhabhas. Also, we have Bhakti, and we have Bhaktiabhas. So for most of us, because we're still fighting with our miserable conditioning. If you ever look in the mirror, you can see how miserable it looks. I shouldn't say that for all of you because you have beautiful smiles. But so we have Shraddha and Shraddhabhas. Okay, so now Shraddhabhas, or mixed faith, has two aspects. One is called Chaya, the other is called Pratibimba. Chaya means shadowy. Pratibimba means reflective. Reflective faith can almost never be transformed into pure faith. Even if a person is practicing devotional activities, but within his heart he's maintaining reflective faith, he may go on for, Rupa Goswami gives a verse, he may go on for millions of lifetimes like that. However, shadowy faith can easily be overcome and come to the stage of pure faith. Okay? Now, examples of this. Okay, modern day examples. Okay, I'm going to read this now to you. Try to pay attention and I'll read section by section so it won't be so hard. Okay, in summary, the semblance of faith is either a reflection or a shadow of pure faith. Although these two types of semblance of faith may have many subdivisions, the characteristic common to all of them is the conviction that happiness can be found in some activity
outside pure devotional service to Krishna. So this is, we got to look deeply in our heart. Whenever we conduct any activity, we have to see, am I doing this because I think I'm going to get happiness from this? Because it's service to Krishna, or because I can get some happiness here just for myself? That this is the really where faith, pure faith, and the semblances of faith come from. Okay. Although reflective semblance of faith is difficult to purify, shadowy semblance of faith is not. Shadowy faith is easily purified in the company of pure Vaishnavas. So this is another thing, how important it is for us to be in the association of devotees. When persons with shadowy faith carefully understand the principles of transcendental knowledge, when they worship Krishna under the guidance of pure devotees, they purify their conditioned natures. Pure faith then enlightens them and makes them eligible for pure devotion. So we have to understand, first we're trying to achieve pure faith. Then we can talk about pure devotion. Okay? So persons who do not avail themselves of the company of pure devotees and who do not apply themselves to understanding pure devotion remain under the influence of the modes of nature. Okay? So just try to understand, unless we associate with devotees, especially advanced devotees, and unless we, what's the other point? And unless we apply ourselves to understanding pure devotion, that means taking the time to go in depth into this literature. Srila Prabhupada recommended going to India at least once a year and to enter into programs like the VIHE courses, where you have no other responsibilities than studying these books. You see, that level of study, okay, will really help to clarify ourselves from being influenced by our past conditioning. Okay? In this pure devotion, in this way, past conditioning... Okay, I'm sorry, I read something wrong. But persons who do not avail themselves of the company of pure devotees and who do not apply themselves to understand pure devotion remain under the influence of the modes. In this way, past conditioning dominates and determines the nature of their faith. Okay, the semblance of faith may be a key to the heavenly planets, or even to a semblance of liberation, mukti abhas. But it can never grant the type of liberation that awakens the soul's original form, as described by Sukadeva Goswami. You see? Liberation, this is a quote from Sukadeva Goswami, liberation is the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross, and subtle material body. It's called Jivan Mukta, when a person actually realizes their eternal spiritual form. Not a hallucination, but the actual realization of our spiritual self-identity as an associate and servant of Krishna. Okay, now, so, O Vaishnava readers, possessed of pure faith, guard your treasure carefully and nurture it with pure devotional activities. There are many people in the dress of Vaishnavas who market distorted ideologies. These miscreants can contaminate your faith and turn you from the path of pure devotion left to us by our ever-well-wisher. Please be on guard. Okay, now here we go into our topic here. The examples of such contemporary ideologies, okay? What are examples? The Ritvik philosophy. Okay, so let's look at this. The Ritvik philosophy concocted by apparently well-wishing followers of Srila Prabhupada is one such example. Okay, Ritvik's claim that even after the departure of His Divine Grace, one can become His direct initiated disciple. The Rigvedic philosophy accepts Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And so it is not overtly Mayavadi. Still, it is distorted and is thus impure. It has impersonalist undertones characteristic of traditional sahajiyas and is an obstacle to pure devotion for the following reasons. Okay, so let's look at these reasons now. So, even though it seems the same, people are worshipping Prabhupada, they're worshipping Krishna, they're reading Srimad Bhagavatam. It seems the same, but it is contaminated with a concocted idea. Okay, so now let's look at this. Rigvedics agree that their understanding of initiation is not standard. But they say that their recommended process for connecting with the disciplic succession is acceptable due to Srila Prabhupada's extraordinary empowered status. Yet the suggestion that Srila Prabhupada was empowered to act contrary to scripture and Vaishnava tradition, or would use his empowerment to do so, is an insult rather than a praise. Why? Srila Prabhupada repeatedly emphasized that his empowerment came from strictly following the scripture and his predecessors. He was proud of his fidelity. To suggest that Prabhupada was unchaste to his spiritual heritage, that he was an independent, absolute authority, is to attribute to him a status that Karta Bhaja Sahajiyas attribute to their gurus. Okay, now this is a little technical, but let's try to look at this, okay? Alright. It also resembles the Mayavad philosophy in the way it twists the meaning of scripture to suit its own preconceived conclusions by means of an indirect indirect explanations called Gona Vritti. Okay, so now these two points. Okay, the first point is it is similar to the Sahajiyas. Why? Because the followers are saying that Prabhupada would do something outside of following his guru and the previous acharyas and scriptures. And he can do that because he's empowered. Now this is like the Sahajiyas. But for example, we have one group called the Nityananda Jata Gosanis. And they claim that Lord Nityananda himself empowers them as his representatives, because of their seminal connection to Lord Nityananda, because they were born in a family line coming from Lord Nityananda. But Lord Nityananda never teaches that. But they said because of his extraordinary position, we are born in his family, so now we are the representatives of Lord Nityananda. This is the same as the Rigvedics, claiming their connection to Prabhupada because of Prabhupada's extraordinary position. Hare Krishna. You want to give some prasadam to our guests who are leaving? Okay, so this is one point. Okay? Also, the example of the Mayavadis, who you may have all heard this example, just like we have this ladder here in the back of the room. So the Mayavadis compare their guru to be just like a ladder. Now they climb up the ladder to the top, and once they get to the top of the roof, they kick the ladder away. They no longer need the ladder. So, yeah. So in the same way, they are using Prabhupada's extraordinary position to claim themselves now as the authorities of devotional service, and now they are disregarding Prabhupada's teachings, disregarding Prabhupada's institution, disregarding Prabhupada's connection to the disciplic succession. Just like the Mayavadis kick the ladder away. And so therefore it becomes a fault, it becomes an offense, rather than a praise. Okay, Srila Prabhupada repeatedly emphasized that his empowerment came from strictly following scripture and his predecessors. Okay,
Moreover, the Ritvik's core argument that ISKCON's future generations have an inherent right to the direct Diksha connection with Srila Prabhupada is much akin to the Jata Goswami Sahajiyas, who claim a spiritual lineage to Lord Nityananda. That's what I was describing to you. For instance, solely by seminal ties. Both groups lay claim to a concocted spiritual heritage without the explicit empowerment from their founder. This core argument also clears the way for all devotees for all time to jump over the line of disciplic succession to Srila Prabhupada. It obscures the truth that serving the servant of the servant is superior to direct service. Like we have this term, dasa, dasa, nudasa. Actually, we achieve love of God not by directly trying to serve Krishna, but by serving the servant of Krishna. Who thinks they're a better servant to Krishna than Srimati Radharani? Why do you want to jump over her head to serve Krishna? Do you think you are better servants of Krishna than Radharani? Who can say that? It's an insult. It will not bring us closer to Krishna. In fact, it's a joke. Krishna will end up slapping you in the face, if you're lucky. How can we think we can just jump over the head of these previous acharyas? Jump over the head of Radharani ultimately. Krishna himself in the Mahabharata, he says that he who claims to be my devotee is not actually my devotee. But he who claims to be the servant of my servant is my real devotee. Who is a better servant than Arjuna and the Pandavas? Why do we have to jump over his head? Are you ready to receive the arrows of Arjuna when you're jumping over him? I don't think we are. You see? So, this point, you know, is very critical. It looks the same, but it's not. You see? So, now, one last thing here and we'll stop. And I'll finish this description here. In this sense, it is similar to the rebellious mood of the Mayavadis, who accept the disciplic succession not as an eternal reality, but as a temporary means to liberation. Alright? Okay, I'll just read this one more time. The core argument also clears the way for all devotees, for all time, to jump over the line of disciplic succession to Srila Prabhupada. It obscures the truth that serving the servant of the servant is superior to direct service. It also opens a Pandora's box by allowing anyone direct access to any member of the disciplic succession, including Krishna himself. In this sense, it is similar to the rebellious mood of Mayavadis who accept the disciplic succession not as an eternal reality, but as a temporary means to liberation, and who then want to be the Lord rather than anyone's servant. Just like, I'll give you a very good example of this. There was this Mayavadi group, they came to the United States and they were speaking. So some devotees came to their course. So the guru of the Mayavadis, he started to tell the audience, he said to the audience, you see those ISKCON members? They are interested to become the servant. But I am interested to teach you how to become the master. And everybody's, yes, I want to be the master. You see? But actually becoming the master, that position is already taken. Very sorry. And who will be the better master than Krishna? Right? We know that story of Pundraka in Krishna book, right? He put on the fake arm. That's a very good drama actually, if you ever want to do a drama, that would be very funny. Pundraka. Right? So, it seems attractive. Yes, master, you know? Yes. Like that, yes, let me pass over the acharya. Let me become the direct servant of Krishna, you know? Or or whichever guru I find in the menu, you know. You see? Today, let me try. I will be the direct one of Bhaktivinod. Tomorrow, I will be the direct one of Vishwanath Chakravarti. Actually, by being the servant of the servant, we do get access to these great acharyas. You see? So, now, this concludes here that Ritviks may have strong faith. Right? When you see them, they seem to have very strong faith. Right? And another point I want to put in this too, and this is something that I've observed, it's not mentioned here. That, for example, if you look at the Bangalore temple, it's very successful. However, based on this analysis, it is not due to pure devotional service. Though there may be some pure devotional service there, the people that I'm meeting who are going there and doing, giving money and doing service, many of them are very innocent. I think for them, I could say that they are performing some level of devotional service. However, the management and the men and women who are adhering to this Ritvik philosophy, they are successful not because of pure devotion, but rather because of their material abilities. So we should not mix somebody's material qualifications and their achievements, even seemingly in devotional service, with pure devotion. It seems they're very successful, but that success is based on their material qualifications. You see? You could bring, say, Lee Kuan Yew here, and I think he could manage this program better than me. Because he's tremendously qualified as a manager. But his qualification does not mean he is a pure devotee. So we should always be careful to mind that. So it says here, Ritviks may have strong faith, but like other wayward Vaishnav groups, their faith is based on defective knowledge. Thus, it should be recognized as a mere semblance of faith and rejected. So that's the difference. And we should understand that. And even if somebody has better managerial qualifications or they have some more contacts than we have or whatever, we should still understand those successes are not a result of pure devotion based on this wonderful explanation. So we should continue now developing our faith in this pure line and understand that pure faith leads to pure devotion. The stronger our faith comes, and that faith is based on understanding that our only happiness will come in serving Krishna with pure love. Okay, so I'll stop here. Thank you very much for your kind attention. I'm sorry I went over time here. And thank you. It's very nice of you to give me the opportunity to read Srimad Bhagavatam with you. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Grantharaj Bhagavatam ki jai. Lord Bhaktivinoda ki nitya gaur Paramananda hari bo. So we have to save our questions and comments, and I'm going to turn this over now to Prabhupada.